today, as I say, we've got the subject of career, and we've got two very eminent specialists to talk to us about it. We can introduce them both together at the moment and then ask each to speak for about 15 minutes. And as usual, we'll open it to the floor to ask questions or make comments. But I will talk about that a little more when we get to that. On my right, we have John Everard, who was educated at King's School of Chester and won an exhibition to Emmanuel College, Cambridge. He knows a lot about Korea. He served as our ambassador in Korea from 2006 to 2008. He was then appointed on the as coordinator of the United Nations Security Council panel of experts, which dealt with sanctions on the DPRK. He withdrew from that position on November 2012, and since then he's written extensively for the media and broadcast, both on Korean issues and on international affairs generally. He did, however, publish a book in 2012 called Only Beautiful, Please, that described his experiences of living and working in the DPRK and discussed some of the challenges presented by that country. He did say to me, and I said I would mention that, just to mention there are one or two copies still available if anybody would like. On my left, Shashank Joshi, who many of you know from radio and television performances. He's a senior research fellow in RUSI. He specialises in foreign security and defence policies in Asia. He holds degrees from Cambridge and Harvard, where he was a Kennedy Scholar. He's regularly lectured at the UK Defence Academy and given evidence to the House of Commons Foreign and Defence Committees. So again, another expert, and I will ask him to speak to us after John Everard has spoken. John, would you like to talk to us?
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Thank you for the very kind words of introduction. Summary, for those who want to make an early getaway, what I'm going to say is that the situation really is dangerous. The answer to the question in the title, North Korea and the West, the brink of war, is possibly yes. It's not inevitable, but the risks are real. Both the US and North Korea have got themselves into situations from which it's got to be difficult for them to climb down without significant loss of face, which both in Washington and in Pyongyang is politically dangerous. I actually put most of my notes together this morning. I'm glad I did, because, of course, two big things happened this morning which affect the situation around the Korean Peninsula. One, obviously, is the swearing-in of the new president of South Korea, President Moon Jae-in. The other is the dismissal of Comey, of the head of the FBI. I'll explain why that's relevant in a moment. But first I want to do a kind of tour of the horizon to explain what is driving, or rather what I think is driving, the four key actors in this situation and the attendant risks. Let's start with Washington, where, as you know, President Trump made solving, quote-unquote, the North Korean issue a core plank of his campaign. His strategy, does Donald Trump have strategies? Anyway, if there is one, it is to apply unprecedented pressure on Pyongyang to force the abandonment of its nuclear programs, and at the same time, but that was the stick, the carrot is the prospect of high-level dialogue. Remember how he talked about perhaps having a hamburger with Kim Jong-un. The thought of Kim Jong-un eating a hamburger sort of fills me with glee. But and then more recently he said that he'd be honoured to sit down with Kim Jong-un, which makes the hamburger option look attractive in comparison. So pressure, we have, of course, the USS Carl Vinson, the entire carrier task force, still sitting off the shore of Korea. Other military deployments, which I won't list here. Constant consultation with the Chinese. President Trump clearly believes, in fact he said, that he believes that China is the key to all this. China can put the real pressure on North Korea, sufficient to force Kim Jong-un's regime to abandon its nuclear weapons. And the latest round in this, little birds tell me, is that he has passed a message through the Chinese to the North Koreans that if the North Koreans will denuclearize, that the United States is prepared to make clear to the world it has no intention of attacking let alone invading North Korea, and that it will desist from pushing for early reunification of the peninsula. The North Koreans have yet to respond to this point, and of course may not do so. If all this is correct, we're going round in a circle. This is part of the agreement reached on 19 September 2005, so 12 years ago now, where the North Koreans committed to complete irreversible and verifiable denuclearization in exchange for pretty much the same US package. Let's see whether they bite this time. What we don't know is what President Trump might do if all this doesn't work, what his plan B is. He keeps talking about other options, and clearly with the amount of military hardware in the area, he has at least one military option in mind. But would he actually press the trigger? And what in particular, nobody really knows, perhaps not even Donald Trump himself, what he will do if North Korea carries out its threat of a sixth nuclear test or an ICBM launch. There does seem to be a risk that he is called out on this and made to seem a paper tiger. I mentioned earlier the effect of the dismissal of Comey. I think it's clear to everybody that the Trump presidency is in deep trouble, that we don't know quite what it was that prompted this dismissal. The avowed reasons are unlikely to be genuine. And if indeed the FBI was close to producing a smoking gun on Russian involvement in the US election campaign, then we have a severely compromised president. I raise this because we've seen in a variety of different fora how President Trump, and indeed candidate Trump, attempts to deflect and distract when he gets into difficulties. If he gets into serious difficulties domestically, rather as President Clinton responded to the whole Monica Lewinsky affair, you recall that in 1998 he authorised strikes on Iraq, there is, it seems to me, a risk that Donald Trump, being Donald Trump, might actually authorise military action against North Korea for parallel reasons, which leaves me feeling slightly uncomfortable. A footnote to the America section of this, if you like. A lot of people call for dialogue between the United States and North Korea. Ladies and gentlemen, we are knee-deep in dialogue. I counted last year four separate dialogue channels between the United States and North Korea. None of them government-to-government officially, many of them containing senior US officials not wearing their official suits, so to speak, and all of them involving senior North Koreans. The problem is not that we have been short of dialogue. The problem has been the North Koreans have shown over a long period that they are simply not interested in negotiating away their nuclear weapons. There's a bit more dialogue coming up. I think there's a meeting coming up in Oslo later this month. We'll see whether that gets anywhere. OK, that's how I think, what I think is driving Washington. Let's turn to Pyongyang. One key point that is so easy to forget when you're discussing Kim Jong-un's actions is that he, too, has domestic pressures. It's not always fun being a dictator. You have to listen to people and you have to consult. And his position is shaky. Just last week, the regime announced that it had foiled an assassination attempt on Kim Jong-un by a North Korean by the name of Kim, which doesn't exactly narrow the field very much, but anyway. And it blamed this plot on the CIA and the South Korean National Intelligence Service, and it started a huge purge. So there's a lot of fear and angst going around Pyongyang right now. In general, in North Korean politics, you have to stand firm and you have to walk tall, you have to look strong. Failure to do any of those things can have the most unpleasant consequences, particularly if, as now, you are a leader, perhaps not one of the world's great liberal thinkers, but you are surrounded by people who make you look really quite liberal in comparison. Some of the old generals that you see walking around with Kim Jong-un are watching him all the time for the first sign of weakness. He daren't show weakness. And giving up nuclear weapons under American pressure would probably domestically be a very bad idea. At the same time, he's under countervailing pressures. Sanctions, famously, have not stopped the nuclear programs, but they have hurt. And they are hurting much more now than they used to, particularly since the Chinese banned the import of North Korean coal in January this year. The North Korean coal exports to China account for between a quarter and a third of all North Korea's foreign currency earnings. It's a terrific blow on the North Korean economy. If the Chinese ever follow through on the threat that emerged, not an official challenge, it's true, but in Global Times, to restrict oil supplies to North Korea, that really would cause the economy to collapse. So Kim Jong-un is facing very complex pressures in both directions. He needs, for his own political survival, to keep the outer elite of Pyongyang sweet. For that, he needs a flow of money, and harsher sanctions compromise that flow and therefore compromise his ability to keep people happy and undermine his domestic position. When you talk to North Koreans, they will always politely say, yes, of course, you know, US invasion, boo-boo, imperialists. What they really worry about is not the Americans, it's their own people. They are much more frightened of being strung up from lampposts than they are of being bombed by the US Air Force. Kim Jong-un has publicly and repeatedly committed to retaining his nuclear weapons. To go against that now would be politically damaging, and it would require a great deal of wriggling to work his way out of the very pronouncements he's made. One of the curiosities of the situation is that Donald Trump can, and often does, do U-turns. Kim Jong-un can't. Notice that so far, ever since the crisis entered its current iteration, Kim Jong-un has played safe. He has not launched an ICBM. He has not gone for a further nuclear test, probably believing, and probably rightly, that those really are red lines and that they might bring the sky down on him. Interestingly, the display of hardware, the live fire exercises on Army Day on 25th of April, which attracted some attention here, yes, spectacular, but all legal. None of what they did that day, apart from the launch of a medium-range missile, which he knows he can just not get away with, none of it is actually banned by the Security Council. The other thing, of course, from Pyongyang's point of view, is uncertainty over what President Moon might do. This might cut two ways. Firstly, he might want to play things long to see whether President Moon does actually follow through on the statement he made on 23rd of April with economic aid for the DPRK, for North Korea, or he might calculate that if he's going to test a nuclear device, if he's going to launch an ICBM, do it now before Seoul and Washington get their act together, catch them both on the back foot and possibly minimise responses, which suggests that the next few days and weeks are going to be a little bit tense. And typically North Korean, of course, he has now got a total of four US hostages held in Pyongyang on rather dubious charges, almost certainly because he hopes thereby to persuade President Trump to either come to Pyongyang himself, ho-ho, or to send a high-level envoy to negotiate their release. President Trump has shown no sign whatever of doing any such thing so far, but it's typical North Korean that they do this. Turning now to the new government of Moon Jae-in, very new. He's only been in office a few hours. So we're a bit short on policy statements as president on which to draw. On 23rd of April, so a little before the election, he did, however, set out a vision of a relationship with North Korea that involved a return to the Sunshine Policy. Remember the policy pursued by some previous South Korean presidents, which involved great generosity to North Korea, a lot of money, and a lot of engagement, a lot of talking, which of course would cut straight across the policies currently being pursued by President Trump. Before we get too excited about this, there are three big constraints on President Moon's ability to revert to that kind of policy. Firstly, he has said publicly last week that before he approaches North Korea, he will consult Washington. He's signalling he has no intention of going rogue. He's talked very warmly about the US-South Korean alliance and indicated he has no intention of messing around with that. I imagine he'll want to talk to President Trump. He's seeking an early meeting with him before doing anything about a change in policy. Secondly, the main reason that President Moon was elected was not North Korea. It was despair and disgust amongst the South Korean electorate at the antics of the South Korean right wing, the corruption, rumours that you had geomancers determining policy in the Blue House, the exposure of constant bribery and counter-bribery at the top of the chaebols, at the top of the South Korean system. People are worried about the economic structures, they are worried about the economy, they are worried about their economic futures. The Sunshine policy was and would be again hideously expensive, billions and billions of dollars. At a time like this, getting the National Assembly to authorise that kind of expenditure would be frankly extremely difficult, particularly as, and this is the third constraint, he doesn't have a parliamentary majority. 299 seats in the South Korean National Assembly, his party controls 119, and a lot of the others are conservative. He's going to be constrained by that too. So what he actually does in office, I think, remains to be seen. I think the jury is still out. If he does, despite all this, go for just full unconditional economic assistance to Pyongyang, that clearly would cut across the efforts by a lot of other countries. It would probably strain relations with Washington really very badly. If it turns out that what he really means is conditional economic assistance, that under the right conditions, one of President Moon's favourite phrases, he would be prepared to offer carrots to go to Pyongyang, he said this morning, then that might well fit into a broader strategy of carrots and sticks as some of the carrots. If you are serious about denuclearising about ending your nuclear programs, then perhaps South Korea will give you lots of money. I can't get through the speech without mentioning THAAD at least once, the term higher altitude aerial defense system that China is so angry about. It's now installed, it's operational. It's going to be difficult for President Moon to roll back on that. He's promised a conversation about it, but whether he can actually get a change, whether he actually really wants a change, and whether in any case any change to the deployment that he might achieve would be sufficient to allay Chinese anxieties. Remember, China is convinced the whole thing's about them, that it's just an excuse to have radars on the THAAD system that can look into northeast China. That any change that President Moon might, whether any change that he can make would satisfy China, I think is in doubt. Fourthly, lastly, how do things look from Beijing? Beijing is in a state of deep nervousness about the whole situation. At no time does China want disorder on the Korean Peninsula. It threatens the stability of China's own provinces. The Global Times, a rather right-wing nationalist newspaper, described instability spilling across the border into China's northeastern provinces as a Chinese red line a couple of weeks ago. The one thing that China wants less than the instability on the peninsula is war on the peninsula. And I think there's deep concern that at the moment there's a real chance that President Trump and Marshal Kim Jong-un, between them, might actually lumber into a war if not carefully watched. So China has been, for the past several weeks, desperately trying to work out what it needs to do to stop this happening. You can see it's trying to accommodate United States concerns to a large degree. I've mentioned already the implementation of United Nations sanctions on coal imports from North Korea, floating the idea of restricting oil supplies. On the other hand, of course, it doesn't want to upset Pyongyang, and we're getting this strange dual messaging. If you read official Chinese statements about what is going on, They are all motherhood and apple pie, about exercising restraint, about the need for dialogue and so on. And I'm quite sure that those are the ones that they are basing their conversations, such as they have, with North Korea on. On the other hand, you have this quite separate stream of messages coming through the semi-official state papers, particularly Global Times, saying that China's people are fed up with North Korea, they're regarded as a burden, talking about strengthening sanctions, and this, of course, is for American consumption. So, quite different messages aimed at two different audiences. Which one is actually closer to Chinese real thinking, they are very carefully not saying. I'm going to finish by suggesting how things might go right or wrong from here. How might things go right? It's, at the moment, quite paradoxically, and I think without any huge amount of planning, the United States has succeeded in a long-term aim, that the North Koreans have desisted from any further tests. The United States has succeeded, effectively, in freezing North Korea's weapons of mass destruction programs because the North Koreans can't be sure now that they can test without the most terrible consequences. Now, they'll have been watching what President Trump did in Syria, the dropping of the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, and will be sort of gnashing their teeth slightly. It may be that this situation can be held for a while, perhaps for a long while, we don't know. It would require, I'm sure the crew of the Carl Vinson, already chafing at losing their Australian shore leave, will want to go home at some stage, will have to rotate, but it will require at least a carrier battle group off the coast of Korea for quite a long time. If President Trump is prepared to keep that commitment, then maybe the current freeze will continue. But things might go seriously and devastatingly wrong. It's possible to draw up long lists of scenarios in which this might happen. I think the two most likely ones are, firstly, that North Korea decides that for one reason or another, whether for domestic pressure or for technical reasons, that it has to take the risk and it has to conduct a sixth nuclear test. If that happens, China is going to be furious. We may well see strong Chinese retaliation against North Korea. It may be that at that point, President Trump decides that a military strike against North Korea is the only way forward. And you can see that you quickly get into a downward spiral of escalation, which will be very difficult to stop. The other possibility is either that President Trump decides he needs a distraction from domestic difficulties, a possibility to which I alluded earlier, or that, rightly or wrongly, he considers that a sixth test is imminent. So there's quite a lot riding on the quality of US intelligence here. If he decides that the North Koreans are about to test, I think there's a real chance that he would order a limited strike on the test site. We don't know, or he doesn't know, where the North Koreans store all their nuclear weapons, but we do know where the test site is, and a strike on the site would probably prevent a test. It would also probably kill many of the fairly small number of scientists that North Korea depends on to carry its programs forward. And Donald Trump being Donald Trump, I would say that there's a real risk he might actually do that. And on that cheerful note, this is Edmund. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me? Great. Let me just zoom out for a moment after that fantastic survey and ask, what is it that has changed about North Korea's missile and nuclear program that prompts us to ask this rather dramatic question, are we on the brink of war? And a few things have changed very significantly. First of all, there has been a dramatic increase in the number of missile tests that we've seen. Kim Jong-il conducted about 16 missile tests in 17 years. Kim Jong-un has managed about 70 tests in 6 years. That includes more tests this year and the past year than in all of North Korea's history combined. So there's a qualitative shift in the frequency of missile tests. And of course, missiles are the principal delivery system for his nuclear arsenal. Second of all, and this is very interesting given what the note John ended on the question of a limited strike rather than a larger strike, launches are now occurring all over the country, and not just at test sites. These are missile launches. Specifically, many of the most recent launches of short and medium-range Scud and Nodong missiles have been conducted not as tests, not as developmental tests, fine-tuning the missile, but as military exercises at the training grounds of the specific DPRK military units that would be responsible for using those missiles in the event of a conflict. So, in other words, North Korea is not just honing its missiles, it's practicing warfare against nuclear warfare against American and allied military bases in Asia. That dispersal of tests, the fact that these are across multiple sites under operational conditions by military units, also has serious implications for the US's or other countries' ability to conduct limited strikes and keep them limited as well. Thirdly, and I think this is probably the most significant trend or shift, although it's perhaps slower moving than we might be led to believe, DPRK is also moving towards the acquisition of an intercontinental ballistic missile, or ICBM, capability, making it able to hit the US mainland for the first time if it achieves that capability. On the 15th of April, on its parade, the North Korea paraded canisters containing what were thought to be two new types of ICBM. Canisterization means, effectively, these missiles can be moved, prepared, and launched more easily, quickly, and reliably than before. And that, of course, makes it significantly harder for us to locate them, identify them, and destroy them on the ground. There's a number of other countries, India, for example, also moving towards the canisterization of its their ballistic missiles. And then, of course, finally, as North Korea conducts more tests, the next would be its sixth, and I think it probably will come within the next 12 months, it gets better at miniaturizing the warheads necessary to fit on top of those missiles. And it can now produce around 6 to 7 bombs, add around 6 to 7 bombs to its arsenal every week, according to some of the technical estimates. So what are the implications of all of this? Well, North Korea has always had a substantial conventional deterrent ability. Even when North Korea was at its weakest and the United States at its strongest in the mid-1990s, we still saw significant conventional deterrence at play when the Clinton administration contemplated a strike. Its tens of thousands of artillery pieces means it's always had the ability to inflict massive damage on South Korea, including on the capital, Seoul. As its ballistic missile capability grows, that short and medium range ballistic missile capability that is now being tested with increasing frequency and effectiveness, that has two implications. One of them is that the estimated damage to South Korea grows much bigger, and the range of damage also extends to other cities and bases in Asia, including the Japanese bases through which the US would have to stage its military forces, because, of course, reinforcements and the bulk of military force could not come from a carrier group. It would have to come through US bases in Asia, resupplied from the United States and other parts of Asia and Southeast Asia. The deterrent effect of that shift, which is growing significantly bigger than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I think, cannot be ignored. We cannot pretend as if the costs of a campaign, even a limited campaign, would be the same as they would have been just a decade ago. The second change, and here I think this is the crux of the issue, the crux of what makes this a real crisis, or lends this the sense of crisis that we have seen in the past month, is the vulnerability or the potential vulnerability of American cities. As long as Kim can only target South Korea and Japan, the US can, in theory, contemplate an invasion or a strike that would only affect its allies, only the tens of thousands of US troops in the region, and of course other US facilities in the Pacific or elsewhere. But once American cities are at risk, that calculation changes in very fundamental ways. American guarantees to allies, including the nuclear guarantees, extended deterrence, come at a significantly higher price, and perhaps an altogether incredible price. We, as Europeans, I think, have a sense of this. If we cast our minds back to the 1950s, when the Soviet Union first acquired the ability to strike the United States with ballistic missiles, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles at that time worried that American bases in Europe would come to be seen by the Europeans themselves not as umbrellas defending Europe, but as lightning rods, inviting attacks, inviting destruction onto those allies at the same time. So the fear isn't just that the US may abandon its allies for fear of the impact of North Korean missiles on its own cities. It's more than that. It's also that the allies themselves might pay an enormous price in the process, which, as Dulles noted at the time, would strain the will to fight and spur neutralism. Now, that's a risk of alliance decoupling, a risk that we've talked about a great deal in the past months, and, of course, which has great significance in light of yesterday's elections, the prospect of a Sunshine Policy Part 2, around which there, of course, is a great deal of uncertainty. We shouldn't assume that that's where we're headed, as John made very clear, but we do see a risk of wedges in the alliance, wedges that are not just to do with South Korea's domestic politics, but are also powerfully driven by this feature of American cities being at risk. We cannot pretend that a US administration would take that for granted, and indeed spokesmen in the US have, when asked, would you strike North Korea, how do you feel about this, have said, of course, the president's first priority is the safety of the American people. That, of course, is the wrong answer for allies. And, of course, such steps by South Korea in the direction of more conciliatory policy may be viewed by officials, and, of course, particularly by this administration, as evidence of weak South Korean commitment to the alliance, something to which they're acutely sensitive, as we know in Europe, creating a cycle of mistrust. So all of that should sensitise us to the problem of a growing capability in North Korea's ballistic missiles and nuclear forces. But does that justify the sense of war scare that we've seen in the past month? And I, on balance, probably no. The Trump administration has been manipulating and exaggerating the threat of war to deter North Korea, understandably. The economist Thomas Schelling, who died earlier this year, talked about manipulating risk, manipulating the fear of things getting out of control to deter one's adversaries, cultivating impetuosity. That is much easier for someone like Trump to do than it would have been for Obama to do. And I think arguably it has paid some dividends. I think Trump does get some of the right effects for the wrong reasons sometimes. But I also think more sober voices in the Trump administration tell a slightly different story. On 17th of April, for example, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, one of the so-called axes of adults in the White House, declared that this problem is coming to a head. It's time for us to undertake all actions we can short of a military option. I think there's a great opportunity for all of us to take action short of armed conflict so we can avoid the worst. In other words, there's a clear recognition that that option is perhaps less credible than you would think from looking at the optics, the carrier groups and the signalling. Now, that's not to say there are no mixed messages. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, for example, has contradicted himself on the question of regime change, first of all taking it off the table, and then the next a few weeks later saying it would only be taken off the table in exchange for denuclearisation. Well, of course, you can't have it all ways. You can't have a bargaining chip that you take off the table and then put back on in the hope that you can dangle it as a carrot. Most dangerous of all was a story we saw on the 13th of April by NBC News, which reported multiple senior US intelligence officials threatening preemptive strikes had there been a North Korean test in what would have been 2 days from then. That report was denied, but of course it's a very dangerous game to play. It may have short-term effects, it may keep adversaries on their toes, but of course that ambiguity may also be taken as evidence of a continued existential threat. And it may also be taken in certain circumstances as evidence or an indication of a genuine preemptive strike. And the way military doctrines in Northeast Asia are configured, that is incredibly dangerous. I think here we should just state basics. Any preventive war that aimed at destroying North Korea's nuclear capability or nuclear potential, rather than a limited strike, would involve unimaginable damage to cities in South Korea and Japan, massive casualties to allied forces numbering into the millions, and the risk of a conflict between the United States and China. The doctrines of all sides, DPRK, South Korea, and the United States, are configured for preemption, for speed, and for swiftness. And of course, that gives each side incentives to strike first in ways that can be highly destabilizing. And at this stage, the cost of any major conflict against DPRK designed to change regime or designed to destroy its nuclear potential, including particularly the cost to the American allies, who would be the supposed beneficiaries of such a campaign, would far exceed the long-term costs of containing, deterring, and shaping the behaviour of a nuclear North Korea. Now, the Trump administration claims it's discovered a new policy, maximum pressure and engagement. Now, I agree with the scholar Jeffrey Lewis, who says this is a tepid serving of leftovers from the Obama, Bush and Clinton administrations. I think, ultimately, we cannot escape the fact that there are only five basic types of options open to the United States. Disruption, coercion, inducement, deterrence and defence. Disruption is about slowing North Korea down. That includes policies known as left of launch, that is, targeting missiles before they ever reach the launch pad. The most prominent example of that in recent weeks would be the campaign of sabotage through cyber attacks that's been reported in the New York Times, that reportedly began 3 years ago, initiated by the Obama administration. This has the obvious echoes of the famous Stuxnet attacks on Iran's nuclear program, but I think we should be very, very careful here. Stuxnet did not cripple Iran's nuclear program. It set back the program for at most about 18 months, perhaps as little as a few months. What it did is buy time for talks. It bought time for dialogue. In North Korea's case, about 75% of missile launches in the past 3 years have been successful, and new cutting-edge missiles, particularly the ICBMs, are inherently unstable and subject to testing failures, so I think disruption is having only a limited effect. Now, coercion, I think, is where the Trump administration sees the crux of its policy, and that's going to be the pillar of its approach. John's outlined some of the elements of that, and I think he's summarised why there has been real progress, particularly with China's embargo on coal imports, also the impact on crude oil and chemical fertilisers that we've seen as well. I still continue to be sceptical about this. I think what's really notable for me is just how mixed these messages are. And in the last few days, it was very interesting to see China issue an invitation to Pyongyang to attend its flagship Belt and Road Initiative summit, which is being held in 5 days, which is, of course, about connectivity, is about integration, is about economic aid, investment, and so forth. The optics of this are actually very strange and undercut the overall thrust of Chinese messaging, particularly towards the United States. And if China somehow thinks the US isn't aware that the DPRK is coming to its summit, that this is something that they are doing alongside these back-channel or semi-deniable threats, I think that's a very strange belief. I still also think the basic dilemma remains. If there's a level of economic pressure that would force the DPRK to denuclearise, it's probably going to be so high that the probable impact on political stability is going to deter China from applying that pressure in the final instance. I think it will also become harder to persuade China to intensify sanctions if a new South Korean government decides to resume economic aid, subject, of course, to all those hurdles that John mentioned. At this point, we should bring in the intervention by former Director of National Intelligence John Clapper, who spoke last summer to the Council on Foreign Relations while he was still in office, and he said very clearly, I think the notion of getting the North Koreans to denuclearise is probably a lost cause. They are not going to do that. That is their ticket to survival. The best we could probably hope for is some sort of a cap, but they are not going to do that just because we ask. There's going to have to be some sort of significant inducement. I think Clapper's absolutely correct, and I think we have not caught up with this idea in our thinking about the North Korean problem. I think here about the comparison with Iran and the Iran nuclear deal. Of course, DPRK has a very different relationship to the world economy, to the international community, than Iran did, particularly in 2013, as Hassan Rouhani was beginning to sort of campaign and then take office. But also, in a more fundamental way, I think we just have to contend with the fact that North Korea is a nuclear power, and it's been a nuclear power for 10 years, for over 10 years. I was reading a book recently by Michael Lewis called The Undoing Project, which is about the collaboration between the economists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman. And one of their big ideas as Nobel Prize winners was the endowment effect, that you tend to value things you have much more than things you may hypothetically gain. And this is evident in all sorts of experiments. I think this is very significant to bear in mind in the North Korean case. There is no case of any nuclear-armed state giving up its nuclear weapons under these conditions of intense pressure. The South Africa and Ukraine cases are, of course, very, very specific, different cases. If Clapper's correct on that question, if denuclearization is impossible, and if even a freeze would take significant inducement, what does that look like? And I think, in practice, it probably resembles what the former director of the Los Alamos laboratory, Sig Hecker, has said is called the three no's for the three yeses. The three no's are no more bombs, no better bombs, in other words, no testing, and no export of nuclear technology or ballistic missile technology. In return for addressing the North security concerns, probably in the form of negative security assurances that Rex Tillerson has raised and that John mentioned, its energy shortages, and third, its broader economic problems, including aid. The fundamental lesson for me of the Iran deal is not just that sanctions can support dialogue, but also, perhaps more importantly, that you have to abandon unrealistic bargaining positions. And in the Iran deal, that was the concept of zero enrichment. In the North Korea case, it's denuclearization. And I think denuclearization is a concept that we will eventually have to abandon as we proceed. One very last thought, just for 20 seconds. A quick thought on the wider implications of the way the United States handles this issue, and particularly the way it engages China. Trump is an impressionable and inexperienced president who thinks in terms of very simplistic quid pro quos and inflates his own capacity as a dealmaker and bargainer. To maintain China's support, he has already held back from an arms deal for Taiwan, he's removed the threat label in China, a currency manipulator, he's already restricted freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. I think those kind of quid pro quos are going to have very damaging effects on the way allies and partners across Asia, all the way from Korea to Japan to India, view the reliability of the United States, view the reliability of its assurances, and I think they will worry that the next quid pro quo could come at their expense.